true. Necessity and universality must be functions of the knowing subject, not items impressed upon subjects by objects. If we assume that our identity as knowing subjects is implicated in constructing our experiences, then we can assume that our identity will generate certain necessary and universal features of our experiences. Accordingly, we have Kant's central project in the first critique of tracking down 14 such constructive functions of the subject, space and time, as two forms of sensibility, and the 12 categories. As a result of the operations of those constructive functions, we can find necessary and universal features within our experiential world because we have put them there. Now for the payoffs and trade-offs. The first payoff is that the phenomenal world of experience now has necessary and universal features built into it, so we get a nice, orderly world for science to explore. Science is rescued from the unintended skepticism that the empiricists and rationalists had reached, and its aspiration to discover necessary and universal truths is made possible. But there is also the Kantian trade-off. The objects that science explores exist, quote, only in our brain, unquote, so we can never come to know the world outside it. Since the phenomenal world's necessary and universal features are a function of our subjective activities, any necessary and universal features that science discovers in the phenomenal world have application only in the phenomenal world. Science must work with experience and reason, and on Kantian grounds, this means that science is cut off from reality itself. Quote, everything intuited in space or time, and therefore all objects of experience possible to us, are nothing but appearances, that is, mere representations, which, in the manner in which they are represented, as extended beings or as series of alterations, have no independent existence outside our thoughts. Unquote. As for what has independent existence outside our thoughts, nobody knows or can know. From Kant's perspective, that is a trade-off he was happy to make, for science's loss is religion's gain. Kant's argument, if successful, means that, quote, all objections to morality and religion will be forever silenced, and this in Socratic fashion, namely by the clearest proof of the ignorance of the objectors, unquote. Reason and science are now limited to playing with phenomena, leaving the noumenal realm untouched and untouchable. Having denied knowledge, room was made for faith. For who can say what is or is not out there in the real world? Identifying Kant's key assumptions. Kant's strikingly skeptical conclusions depend upon philosophical assumptions that continue to inform contemporary debates between postmodernists and their foes. Most postmodernists take those assumptions to be solid, and many times their foes are at a loss to challenge them. Yet they are the assumptions that must be addressed if postmodernist conclusions are to be avoided, so it is worth highlighting them for future reference. The first assumption is that the knowing subject's having an identity is an obstacle to cognition. This assumption is implicit in many verbal formulations. The critics of objectivity will insist that the mind is not a diaphanous medium, nor is it a glossy mirror within which reality reflects itself, nor is it a passive tablet upon which reality writes. The assumption emerges when those facts are taken to disqualify the subject from awareness of reality. The assumption then is that for awareness of reality to occur, the mind would have to be a diaphanous medium, a glossy mirror, or a passive tablet. In other words, the mind would have to have no identity of its own. It would have to be nothing in itself, and cognition would have to involve no causal processes. The mind's identity and its causal processes are thus taken to be enemies of cognition. The diaphanous assumption is implicit in the relativity and causality of perception arguments that were part of the background problematic to Kant's philosophy. In the relativity of senses argument, the diaphanous assumption plays out as follows. We notice that one person reports seeing an object as red, while another reports seeing it as gray. This puzzles us because it draws our attention to the fact that our sense organs differ in how they respond to reality. This as an epistemological puzzle, however, only if we assume that our sense organs should have nothing to do with our awareness of reality, that somehow awareness should occur by a pure stamping of reality upon our transparent minds. That is, it is a problem only if we assume our senses should operate diaphanously. In the case of the causality of perception argument, the diaphanous assumption is involved if we are puzzled by the fact that consciousness requires that one's brain be in a certain state, and that between that brain state and the object in reality is a causal process involving sense organs. This is puzzling only if we have previously assumed that awareness should be an unmediated phenomenon, that one's brain being in the appropriate state should somehow just happen. That is, the causal process of perception is a puzzle only on the assumption that our senses should have no identity of their own, but rather be a diaphanous medium. In the arguments based on the relativity and the causality of perception, the identity of our sense organs is taken to be the enemy of awareness of reality. Kant generalized this point to all organs of consciousness. The subject's mind is not diaphanous. It has an identity. It has structures that limit what the subject can be aware of, and they are causally active. From this, Kant inferred that the subject is prohibited from awareness of reality, whatever we take our mind's identity to be. In Kant's case, the forms of sensibility and the categories, those causal processes block us. On the Kantian model, our mind's structures are seen not as existing for the purpose of registering or responding to structures that exist in reality, but as existing for the purpose of imposing themselves upon a malleable reality. The question to return to is there not something perverse about making our organs of consciousness obstacles to consciousness? The second key assumption of Kant's argument is that abstractness, universality, and necessity have no legitimate basis in our experiences. This assumption was not original to Kant, but had a long history in the traditional problem of universals and the problem of induction. Kant, however, following Hume, declared the problems to be in principle unsolvable on the realist-objectivist approach, and he institutionalized that declaration in the subsequent history of philosophy. In the case of abstract universal concepts, the argument was that there is no way to account for their abstractness and universality empirically. Since what is given empirically is concrete and particular, abstractness and universality must be added subjectively. The parallel argument in the case of general and necessary propositions was that there is no way to account for their generality and necessity empirically. Since what is given empirically is particular and contingent, generality and necessity must be subjectively added. Institutionalizing this premise is crucial for postmodernism, since what has been added subjectively can be taken away subjectively. Postmodernists, struck by and favoring contingency and particularity for a host of reasons, accept the Humean Kantian premise that neither abstractness nor generality can be derived legitimately from the empirical. Why Kant is the turning point. Kant was the decisive break with the Enlightenment and the first major step toward postmodernism. Contrary to the Enlightenment account of reason, Kant held that the mind is not a response mechanism, but a constitutive mechanism. He held that the mind, and not reality, sets the terms for knowledge. And he held that reality conforms to reason, not vice versa. In the history of philosophy, Kant marks a fundamental shift from objectivity as the standard to subjectivity as the standard. Wait a minute, a defender of Kant may reply. Kant was hardly opposed to reason. After all, he favored rational consistency, and he believed in universal principles. So what is anti-reason about that? The answer is that more fundamental to reason than consistency and universality is a connection to reality. Any thinker who concludes that in principle reason cannot know reality is not fundamentally an advocate of reason. That Kant was in favor of consistency and universality is of derivative and ultimately inconsequential significance. Consistency with no connection to reality is a game based on subjective rules. If the rules of the game have nothing to do with reality, then why should everybody play by the same rules? These were precisely the implications the postmodernists were to draw eventually. Kant was thus different from earlier skeptics and religious apologists. Many earlier skeptics had denied that we can know anything, and many earlier religious apologists had subordinated reason to faith. But earlier skeptics had never been as sweeping in their conclusions. Earlier skeptics would identify particular cognitive operations and raise problems for them. Maybe a given experience is a perceptual illusion, thus undermining our confidence in our perceptual faculties. Maybe it is a dream, thus undermining our confidence in being able to distinguish truth from fantasy. Or maybe induction is only probabilistic, thus undermining our confidence in our generalizations, and so on. But the conclusion of those skeptical arguments would be merely that we cannot be sure that we are right about the way reality is. We might be, but we cannot guarantee it, the skeptics would conclude. Kant's point was deeper, arguing that, in principle, any conclusion reached by any of our faculties must necessarily not be about reality. Any form of cognition, because it must operate a certain way, cannot put us in contact with reality. On principle, because our mind's faculties are structured a certain way, we cannot say what reality is. We can only say how our minds have structured the subjective reality we perceive. This thesis had been implicit in the works of some earlier thinkers, including Aristotle's, but Kant made it explicit and drew the conclusion systematically. Kant is a landmark in a second respect. Earlier skeptics had, despite their negative conclusions, continued to conceive of truth as correspondence to reality. Kant went a step further and redefined truth on subjective grounds. Given his premises, this makes perfect sense. Truth is an epistemological concept. But if our minds are in principle disconnected from reality, then to speak of truth as an external relationship between mind and reality is nonsense. Truth must be solely an internal relationship of consistency. With Kant, then, external reality thus drops almost totally out of the picture, and we are trapped inescapably in subjectivity. And that is why Kant is a landmark. Once reason is in principle severed from reality, one then enters a different philosophical universe altogether. This interpretive point about Kant is crucial and controversial. An analogy may help drive the point home. Suppose a thinker argued the following, quote, "I am an advocate of freedom for women. Options and the power to choose among them are crucial to our human dignity, and I am wholeheartedly an advocate of a woman's human dignity. But we must understand that the scope of a woman's choice is confined to the kitchen. Beyond the kitchen's door, she must not attempt to exercise choice. Within the kitchen, however, she has a whole feast of choices, whether to cook or clean, whether to cook rice or potatoes, whether to decorate in blue or yellow. She is sovereign and autonomous, and the mark of a good woman is a well-organized and tidy kitchen." Unquote. No one would mistake such a thinker for an advocate of woman's freedom. Anyone would point out that there is a whole world beyond the kitchen, and that freedom is essentially about exercising choice, about defining and creating one's place in the world as a whole. The key point about Kant, to draw the analogy crudely, is that he prohibits knowledge of anything outside our skulls. He gives reason lots to do within the skull, and he does advocate a well-organized and tidy mind, but this hardly makes him a champion of reason. The point for any advocate of reason is that there is a whole world outside our skulls, and reason is essentially about knowing it. Kant's contemporary, Moses Mendelssohn, was thus prescient in identifying Kant as, quote, "the all-destroyer," unquote. Kant did not take all of the steps down the road to postmodernism, but he did take the decisive one. Of the five major features of Enlightenment reason, objectivity, competence, autonomy, universality, and being an individual faculty, Kant rejects objectivity. Once reason is so severed from reality, the rest is details, details that are worked out over the next two centuries. By the time we get to the postmodern account, reason is seen not only as subjective, but also as incompetent. highly contingent, relative, and collective. Between Kant and the postmodernists comes the successive abandonment of the rest of reason's features. After Kant, reality or reason, but not both. Kant's legacy to the next generation is a principled separation of subject and object, of reason and reality. His philosophy is thus a forerunner of postmodernism's strong anti-realist and anti-reason stances. After Kant, the story of philosophy is the story of German philosophy. Kant died early in the 19th century, just as Germany was beginning to replace France as the world's leading intellectual nation. And it was German philosophy that set the program for the 19th century. Understanding German philosophy is crucial to understanding the origins of postmodernism. Continental postmodernists such as Foucault and Derrida will cite Heidegger, Nietzsche, and Hegel as their major formative influences, all of them German thinkers. American postmodernists such as Rorty emerged primarily from the collapse of the logical positivist tradition, but will also cite Heidegger and pragmatism as major formative influences. When we look to the roots of logical positivism, we find cultural Germans such as Wittgenstein and the members of the Vienna Circle. And when we look at pragmatism, we find it to be an Americanized version of Kantianism and Hegelianism. Postmodernism is thus the supplanting of the Enlightenment with its roots in 17th century English philosophy by the Counter-Enlightenment with its roots in late 18th century German philosophy. Kant is central to that story. By the time of his death, Kant's philosophy had conquered the German intellectual world, and so the story of German philosophy became the story of extensions and reactions to Kant. Three broad strains of post-Kantian philosophy emerged. What shall we do, members of each strain asked, about the gulf between subject and object that Kant has said cannot be crossed by reason? First, Kant's closest followers decided to accept the gulf and live with it. Neo-Kantianism evolved during the 19th century, and by the 20th century, two main forms had emerged. One form was structuralism, of which Ferdinand de Saussure was a prominent exponent, representing the broadly rationalist wing of Kantianism. The other was phenomenology, of which Edmund Husserl was a prominent representative, representing the broadly empiricist wing of Kantianism. Structuralism was a linguistic version of Kantianism, holding that language is a self-contained, non-referential system, and that the philosophical task was to seek out language's necessary and universal structural features, those features taken to underlie and be prior to the empirical, contingent features of language. Phenomenology's focus was upon careful examination of the contingent flow of the experiential given, avoiding any existential inferences or assumptions about what one experiences, and seeking simply to describe experience as neutrally and as clearly as possible. In effect, the structuralists were seeking subjective noumenal categories, and the phenomenologists were content with describing the phenomena without asking what connection to an external reality those experiences might have. Structuralism and phenomenology came to prominence in the 20th century, however, and so my focus next will be on the two strains of German philosophy that dominated the 19th century. For those two strains, Kant's philosophy set a problem to be solved, though one to be solved within the constraints of Kant's most fundamental premises. Second, the speculative metaphysical strain, best represented by Hegel, was dissatisfied with the principled separation of subject and object. This strain granted Kant's claim that the separation cannot be bridged epistemologically by reason, and so proposed to bridge it metaphysically by identifying the subject with the object. Third, the irrationalist strain, best represented by Kierkegaard, was also dissatisfied with the principled separation of subject and object. It granted Kant's claim that the separation cannot be bridged epistemologically by reason, and so proposed to bridge it epistemologically by irrational means. Kantian philosophy thus set the stage for the reign of speculative metaphysics and epistemological irrationalism in the 19th century. Metaphysical Solutions to Kant, From Hegel to Nietzsche. Georg W. F. Hegel's philosophy is another fundamentally counter-Enlightenment attack on reason and individualism. His philosophy is a partially secularized version of traditional Judeo-Christian cosmology. While Kant's concerns centered upon epistemology, Hegel's centered upon metaphysics. For Kant, preserving faith led him to deny reason, while for Hegel, preserving the spirit of Judeo-Christian metaphysics led him to be more anti-reason and anti-individualist than Kant ever was. Hegel agreed with Kant that realism and objectivism were dead ends. Kant had transcended them by making the subject prior, but from Hegel's perspective, he had been too wishy-washy in doing so. Kant made the subject responsible only for the phenomenal world of experience, leaving noumenal reality forever closed off to us. This was intolerable to Hegel. After all, the whole point of philosophy is to achieve union with reality, to escape the merely sensuous and finite, and to come to know and be one with the supersensuous and infinite. However, Hegel had no intention of trying to solve the epistemological puzzles about perception, concept formation, and induction that had set Kant's agenda, in order to show us how we might acquire knowledge of the noumenal. Instead, taking a cue from Johann Fichte, Hegel's strategy was to assert boldly an identity of subject and object, thus closing the gap metaphysically. On Kantian grounds, the subject is responsible for the form of awareness. But Kant was still enough of a realist to posit a noumenal reality that was the source of the content that our minds shape and structure. For Hegel, the realist element drops out entirely. The subject generates both content and form. The subject is in no way responsive to an external reality. Instead, the whole of reality is a creation of the subject. Quote, "In my view," unquote, Hegel wrote at the beginning of the Phenomenology of Spirit, quote, "which can be justified only by the exposition of the system itself, everything turns on grasping and expressing the true, not only as substance, but equally as subject," unquote. The subject, with a capital S, that Hegel had in mind is not the empirical individual subject of traditional philosophy. The creative subject, that is also substance, is the universe as a whole, or God, or spirit, or the absolute, of which we individual subjects are mere portions. Realists had seen the universe as a whole as an object or set of objects within which there are some subjects. Hegel reversed that. The universe as a whole is a subject, and within the subject are objects. Such a bold posit solves a lot of problems. We can get even more necessity and universality than Kant had given us. Hume, earlier, had told us that we cannot get necessary and universal truths from reality. Kant, agreeing with Hume's conclusion, had suggested that we supply necessity and universality from ourselves. That grounded necessity and universality, but at a price. Since we supply them subjectively, we cannot be sure that they apply to reality. Hegel agreed with Kant that our minds supply necessity and universality, but said that all of reality is a product of mind, the mind that contains all of our little minds within it. Since reality comes from us, we can know all of reality in all of its glorious necessity. We can also get a universe that does not dehumanize us. Hegel argued that the realist and objectivist models had, by separating subject and object, inevitably led to mechanical and reductionist accounts of the self. By taking the everyday objects of empirical reality as the model and explaining everything in terms of them, they necessarily had to reduce the subject to a mechanical device. But if instead we start with the subject and not the object, then our model of reality changes significantly. The subject, we know from the inside, is conscious and organic. And if the subject is a microcosm of the whole, then applying its features to the whole generates a conscious and organic model of the world. Such a model of the world is much more hospitable to traditional values than the materialist and reductionist leanings of the Enlightenment. Hegel could also claim to be more of an advocate of reason than Kant was. Reason, Kant taught us, is fundamentally a creative function. And, Kant also taught us, it can know only its own phenomenal creations. But having asserted that reason creates all of reality, Hegel could offer the very optimistic, Enlightenment-sounding conclusion that reason can know all of reality. Dialectic and saving religion. We are now, however, talking about a very different reason than the Enlightenment one. Hegel's reason is fundamentally a creative function, not a cognitive one. It does not come to know a pre-existing reality. It brings all of reality into existence. More notoriously, Hegel's reason operates by dialectical and contradictory means, and not in accordance with the Aristotelian principle of non-contradiction. Hegel's dialectic is partly driven by the fact that by the early 19th century, evolutionary ideas are in the air. In contrast to Kant's belief that the subjective categories of reason are necessarily unchanging and universal, Hegel argued that the appropriate categories themselves are changeable. But Hegel's dialectic is a special kind of evolution, one designed less to be responsive to discoveries in biology than to square with Judeo-Christian cosmology. Judeo-Christian cosmology had traditionally been plagued by metaphysical assertions that were repugnant to reason. Respect for reason during the Enlightenment had led accordingly to a significant decline in religious belief among the intellectuals. Aristotelian reason cannot countenance a God that creates something out of nothing, that is both three and one, that is perfect but creates a world that contains evil. Accordingly, the thrust of Enlightenment theology had been to alter religion by eliminating its contradictory theses in order to make it compatible with reason. Hegel's strategy was to accept that Judeo-Christian cosmology is rife with contradictions, but to alter reason in order to make it compatible with contradiction. Here, Hegel made another significant step beyond Kant and further away from the Enlightenment. Kant had come close to the truth, Hegel believed, in developing the antinomies of reason in the first critique. Kant's purpose there was to show that reason is out of its depth when it tries to figure out noumenal truths about reality. He did so by developing four pairs of parallel arguments on four metaphysical issues, and by showing that in each case, reason leads to contradictory conclusions. One can prove that the universe must have had a beginning in time, but one can equally soundly prove that the universe must be eternal. One can prove that the world must be made up of simplest parts, and also that it cannot be, that we have free will, and that strict determinism is true, that God must exist, and that he does not exist. These contradictions of reason show, Kant concluded, that reason can never know reality, and that therefore our reason is limited to structuring and manipulating its subjective creations. Hegel thought that Kant had missed a deep point here. The antinomies are not a problem for reason, contrary to Kant, but rather the key to the whole universe. The antinomies of reason are a problem only if one thinks that logical contradictions are a problem. That was Kant's mistake. He was too trapped in the old Aristotelian logic of non-contradiction. What Kant's antinomies show is not that reason is limited, but rather that we need a new and better kind of reason, one that embraces contradictions and sees the whole of reality as evolving out of contradictory forces. Such a conception of contradictory evolution is compatible with Judeo-Christian cosmology. That cosmology begins with a creation ex nihilo, posits a perfect being that generates evil, believes in a just being that gives humans independent judgment but punishes them for using it, includes accounts of virgin births and other miracles, says that the infinite becomes finite, the immaterial becomes material, the essentially unitary becomes plural, and so on. Given the primacy of that metaphysics, reason must give way. Reason, for example, must be adapted to the demands of this metaphysics of creation. Quote, "As yet, there is nothing, and there is to become something. The beginning is not pure nothing, but a nothing from which something is to proceed. Therefore, being too is already contained in the beginning." The beginning, therefore, contains both, being and nothing. Is the unity of being and nothing? Or is non-being, which is at the same time being, and being, which is at the same time non-being? Unquote. While that account of creation is incoherent from the perspective of Aristotelian reason, such a poetically grand-sounding drama of evolution by contradiction is perfectly rational, if one grants that reason contains within itself contradiction. That analysis consists in seeking the implicit contradiction within anything and teasing it out in order to put the contradictory elements explicitly in tension with each other, thus leading to a resolution that both goes beyond the contradiction to another evolutionary stage, while at the same time preserving the original contradiction, whatever that means. Hegel thus explicitly rejected Aristotle's law of non-contradiction. Absolutely everything depends on, quote, the identity of identity and non-identity, unquote, Hegel wrote in The Science of Logic. Hegelian dialectical reason also differs from Enlightenment reason by implying a strong relativism against the universality of Enlightenment reason. For all of Hegel's talk of the ultimate universal perspective of the absolute, from any other perspective, nothing holds for long. Dialectic injects contradiction into reality at any given time, as well as across eras. If everything is evolving by the clash of contradictions, then what is metaphysically and epistemologically true in one epoch will be contradicted by what is true in the next, and so on. Finally, Hegel's reason differs from Enlightenment reason by not only being creative of reality and embracing contradiction, but also by being a fundamentally collective function rather than an individual one. Here again, Hegel went beyond Kant in rejecting the Enlightenment. While Kant preserved some elements of individual autonomy, Hegel rejected those elements. Just as the Judeo-Christian cosmology sees everything as God working out his plan for the world in, around, and through us, for Hegel, individuals' minds and whole being are a function of the deeper forces of the universe, operating upon them and through them. Individuals are constructed by their surrounding cultures, cultures that have an evolutionary life of their own, those cultures themselves being a function of yet still deeper cosmic forces. The individual is a tiny, emergent aspect of the largest whole, the collective subjects working itself out. And the creation of reality occurs at that level with little or no regard for the individual. The individual is merely along for the ride. Speaking in Philosophy of History, of collective reason's operations, Hegel stated that, as, quote, universal reason does realize itself. We have, indeed, nothing to do with the individual empirically regarded, unquote. Quote, this good, this reason in its most concrete form is God. God governs the world. The actual working of his government, the carrying out of his plan, is the history of the world. Unquote. Hegel's contribution to postmodernism. Hegel's place historically is to have institutionalized four theses in 19th century metaphysics. 1. Reality is an entirely subjective creation. 2. Contradictions are built into reason and reality. 3. Since reality evolves contradictorily, truth is relative to time and place. And 4. The collective, not the individual, is the operative unit. Hegel's influence was and is profound upon future metaphysicians. Among those metaphysicians, fierce debates emerged over secondary theses. Was the clash of contradiction ultimately progressive, as Hegel thought, or was Hegel willfully blinding himself to the totally irrational chaos that Schopenhauer believed reality to be? Was the ontological substrate of clash and contradiction ideal, as Hegel held, or was it material, as Marx argued? Was the process as totally collectivizing as Hegel took it to be? Or were there some individualist elements within an overall collectivizing framework, as Nietzsche asserted? Whatever the variations, the metaphysical themes of clash and conflict, of truth as relative, of reason as limited and constructed, and of collectivism were dominant, For all of their differences with Hegel, postmodernists adopt all four of those theses. Epistemological solutions to Kant. Irrationalism from Kierkegaard to Nietzsche. The Kantians and the Hegelians represent the pro-reason contingent in 19th century German philosophy. While the Hegelians pursued metaphysical solutions to Kant's unbridgeable gap between subject and object, in the process altering reason into something unrecognizable to the Enlightenment, they had competition from the explicitly irrationalist wing of German philosophy. This line of development included major figures such as Friedrich Schleiermacher, Arthur Schopenhauer, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Denmark's lonely contribution to the history of modern philosophy, Søren Kierkegaard. The irrationalists divided over whether religion is true. Schleiermacher and Kierkegaard being theists, and Schopenhauer and Nietzsche being atheists, but all shared a contempt for reason. All condemned reason as a totally artificial and limiting faculty, one that must be abandoned in the bold quest to embrace reality. Perhaps Kant had prohibited access to reality, but he had shown only that reason could not get us there. That left other options open to us: faith, feeling, and instinct. Schleiermacher, 1768 to 1834, came of age in a Kant-dominated intellectual scene, and he took Kant's cue for how religion could respond to the threat of the Enlightenment. Intellectually, most active from 1799, with the publication of On Religion, Speeches to Its Cultural Despisers, Schleiermacher more than anyone made happen the revival of Pietism and Orthodox Protestantism over the course of the next generation. So great was Schleiermacher's influence that, as theologian Richard Niebuhr put it, he, quote, may justifiably be called the Kant of modern Protestantism, unquote. As someone who came of age in the 1790s in Germany, Schleiermacher was broadly Kantian in his approach, embraced wholeheartedly the Kantian rejection of reason's access to reality. Schleiermacher, like Kant, was deeply offended by the assault that reason, science, and naturalism had made on the true faith. Following Hamann, Schleiermacher held that feeling, especially religious feeling, is a mode of cognition, one that gives us access to noumenal reality. Except, argued Schleiermacher, these feelings are not so much directed outward as inward. One cannot grasp noumena directly, but one can phenomenologically inspect oneself, one's deepest feelings, and therein find indirect senses of the divine ultimate. As Hamann had stated, directly confronted religious feeling reveals one's essential nature. When one discovers one's essential nature, the core self-feeling that one is forced to accept is that of absolute dependence. In Schleiermacher's words, quote, the essence of religion is the feeling of absolute dependence. I repudiated rational thought in favor of a theology of feeling, unquote. One should strive to realize oneself by exploring and embracing this feeling of absolute dependence. This required attacking reason, for reason gives one a feeling of independence and confidence. Limiting reason is thus the essence of religious piety, for it makes possible a fully entered into feeling of dependence and orientation toward that being upon which one is absolutely dependent. That being is, of course, God. In the next generation, Kierkegaard, quote, Hamann's most brilliant and profound disciple, unquote, gave irrationality an activist twist. Educated in Germany, Kierkegaard was, like Kant, deeply worried by the beating religion had taken during the Enlightenment. So he was cheered, or at least as cheered as Kierkegaard could ever be, to learn from Kant that reason cannot reach the noumena. The Enlightenment thinkers had said that individuals relate to reality as knowers. On the basis of their acquired knowledge, individuals then act to better themselves and their world. Quote, knowledge is power, unquote, wrote Bacon. But after Kant, we know that knowledge of reality is impossible. So while we must still act in the real world, we do not and cannot have the necessary knowledge upon which to base our choices. And since our entire destinies are at stake in the choices we make, we cannot choose dispassionately between options. We must choose, and choose passionately, all the while knowing that we are choosing in ignorance. For Kierkegaard, the core lesson from Kant was that one must not try to relate to reality cognitively. What is needed is action, commitment, a leap into that which one cannot know, but which one feels is essential to give meaning to one's life. In accordance with Kierkegaard's felt religious needs, what is needed is an irrational leap of faith. It must be a leap because after the Enlightenment it is clear that the existence of God cannot be justified rationally, and it must be irrational because the God that Kierkegaard finds compelling is absurd. But such a leap into the absurd puts one in a crisis. It flies in the face of everything sensible, rational, and moral. So how should one deal with this crisis of both wanting and not wanting to leap into absurdity? In Fear and Trembling, we find Kierkegaard's panegyric to Abraham, a hero of the Hebrew Scriptures who, in defiance of all reason and morality, was willing to turn off his mind and kill his son Isaac. Why? Because God ordered him to. How could that be? Would a good God make such a demand of a man? That makes God incomprehensibly cruel. What about God's promise that through Isaac the future generations of Israel would be born? The demand makes God a promise breaker. What about the fact that it is killing an innocent? That makes God immoral. What about the immense pain that the loss of their son would cause in Abraham and Sarah? That makes God a sadist. Does Abraham rebel? No. Does he even question? No. He shuts down his mind and obeys. That, said Kierkegaard, is the essence of our cognitive relation to reality. Like Abraham, each of us must learn, quote, to relinquish his understanding and his thinking, and to keep his soul fixed upon the absurd, unquote. Like Abraham, we do not know and we cannot know. What we must do is jump blindly into the unknown. Kierkegaard revered Abraham as, quote, a knight of faith, unquote, for his willingness to, quote, crucify reason, unquote, and leap into absurdity. Schopenhauer, also of the generation after Kant and a contemporary of Hegel, disagreed violently with the cowardly attempts to return to religion after the rejection of Enlightenment reason. While Hegel populated Kant's noumenal realm with dialectical spirit, and Schleiermacher and Kierkegaard felt or hoped desperately that God was out there, Schopenhauer's feelings had revealed to him that reality is will, a deeply irrational and conflictual will, striving always and blindly toward nothing. No wonder, then, that reason had no chance of comprehending it. Reason's rigid categories and neat organizational schemes are wholly inadequate for a reality that is the opposite of that. Only like can know like. Only via our own wills, our passionate feelings, especially those evoked in us by music, can we grasp the essence of reality. But most of us are too cowardly to try, for reality is cruel and frightening. This is why we cling to reason so desperately. Reason allows us to tidy things up, to make ourselves feel safe and secure, to escape from the swirling horror that, in our honest moments, we sense reality to be. Only the bravest few have the courage to pierce through the illusions of reason to the irrationality of reality. Only a few individuals of special sensitivity are willing to pierce reason's veil and intuit passionately the seething flow. Of course, having intuited the cruel horror of the seething flow, Schopenhauer wished for self-annihilation. This was the weakness that his disciple Nietzsche urged us to overcome. Nietzsche began epistemologically by agreeing with Kant. Quote, when Kant says, reason does not derive its laws from nature, but prescribes them to nature, this is, in regard to the concept of nature, completely true, unquote. All of the problems of philosophy, from the decadent Socrates to that, quote, catastrophic spider, unquote, Kant, are caused by their emphasis on reason. The rise of the philosophers meant the fall of man, for once reason took over, men, quote, no longer possessed their former guides, their regulating, unconscious, and infallible drives. They were reduced to thinking, inferring, reckoning, coordinating cause and effect, these unfortunate creatures. They were reduced to their consciousness, their weakest and most fallible organ, unquote. And, quote, how pitiful, how shadowy and fleeting, how aimless and capricious the human intellect is, unquote. Being merely a surface phenomenon and dependent upon underlying instinctual drives, the intellect certainly is not autonomous or in control of anything. What Nietzsche meant then, with his passionate exhortations to be true to oneself, is to break out of the artificial and constricting categories of reason. Reason is a tool of weaklings who are afraid to be naked in the face of a cruel and conflictual reality, and who therefore build fantasy intellectual structures to hide in. What we need to bring out the best possible in us is, quote, the perfect functioning of the regulating unconscious instincts, unquote. The yea-sayer, the man of the future, will not be tempted to play word games, but will embrace conflict. He will tap into his deepest drives, his will to power, and channel all of his instinctual energies in a vital new direction. Summary of irrationalist themes. In contrast to Schleiermacher, Kierkegaard, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche, then, Kant and Hegel seem like champions of reason. Yet Kantian and Hegelian assumptions launched the irrationalist movements of the 19th century. The legacy of the irrationalists for the 20th century included four key themes. 1. An agreement with Kant that reason is impotent to know reality. 2. An agreement with Hegel that reality is deeply conflictual and/or absurd. 3. A conclusion that reason is therefore trumped by claims based on feeling, instinct, or leaps of faith. And 4. That the non-rational and the irrational yield deep truths about reality. The death of Nietzsche in 1900 brings us to the 20th century. 19th century German philosophy had developed two main lines of thought, the speculative metaphysical and the irrationalist epistemological. What was needed was a way to bring those two strands of thought together in a new synthesis for the new century. The philosopher who accomplished this was Martin Heidegger. End of chapter 2. Explaining Postmodernism. Chapter 3. The 20th Century Collapse of Reason. Heidegger's Synthesis of the Continental Tradition. Martin Heidegger took Hegelian philosophy and gave it a personal, phenomenological twist. Heidegger is notorious for the obscurity of his prose and for his actions and inactions on behalf of the National Socialists during the 1930s, and he is unquestionably the leading 20th century philosopher for the postmodernists. Derrida and Foucault identify themselves as followers of Heidegger. Rorty cites Heidegger as one of the three major influences on his thinking, the other two being Dewey and Wittgenstein. Heidegger absorbed and modified the tradition of German philosophy. Like Kant, Heidegger believed reason to be a superficial phenomenon, and he adopted the Kantian view of words and concepts as obstacles to our coming to know reality, or being. However, like Hegel, Heidegger believed that we can get closer to being than Kant allowed, though not by adopting Hegel's abstracted third-person pretense of reason with a capital R. Setting aside both reason and reason with a capital R, Heidegger agreed with Kierkegaard and Schopenhauer that by exploring his feelings, especially his dark and anguished feelings of dread and guilt, he could approach being. And like all good German philosophers, Heidegger agreed that when we get to the core of being, we will find conflict and contradiction at the heart of things. So what is new? Heidegger's distinctiveness was his use of phenomenology to get us there. Phenomenology becomes philosophically important once we accept the Kantian conclusion that we cannot start, as realists and scientists do, by assuming that we are aware of an external, independent reality that is made up of objects that we are trying to understand. But, from the phenomenological standpoint, We must also realize that Kant took only a timid half-step. While Kant was willing to give up the noumenal object, he held on to the belief in an underlying noumenal self with a specific nature available to us for our investigation. But a noumenal self underlying the flow of phenomena is just as problematic a notion as the notion of noumenal objects underlying the flow. Recognizing this, Heidegger therefore wanted to start, following Nietzsche's occasional but undeveloped suggestions, without making the assumption of the existence of either an object or a subject. So we start phenomenologically, that is, by simply and clearly describing the phenomena of experience and change. On Heidegger's account, what one finds when starting so is a sense of projection into a field of experience and change. Do not think objects, Heidegger counseled. Think fields. Do not think subject. Think experience. We start small and local with Daseins being projected into reality. Dasein is Heidegger's substitute concept for self, subject, or human being, all of which he thought carried undesirable baggage from earlier philosophy. Heidegger explained his choice of Dasein by defining it as follows, quote, Dasein means being projected into nothing, unquote. Ignoring the nothing for now, it is the being projected that is Dasein, not that, if anything, which is projected or does the projecting. The emphasis is on activity, thus avoiding assumptions that there are two things, a subject and an object, that enter into a relationship. There is simply action, the action of being out there, being thrust into. The being projected reveals and clothes successively over time various semi-stable fields or beings, what we would call objects if we had not already shed our naive realism. Yet the long process of describing the phenomena of being, Heidegger found, led him inexorably to a question, the question that has haunted all of philosophy. What is the being of the various beings? The beings differ and change, come and go. Yet for all their changeability and difference, they still manifest a oneness, a commonality. They all are. What is that being underlying or behind or common to all beings? What makes the beings be? Or, raising the stakes to the Heideggerian question of all questions, why is there even being at all? Why is there not rather nothing? This is no ordinary question. With a question like this, Heidegger pointed out, reason quickly finds itself in trouble, the same kind of trouble that Kant had pointed out with his antinomies. Reason always reaches contradictions whenever it attempts to explore deep metaphysical issues. A question such as, why is there being and not rather nothing, is therefore repugnant to reason. For Heidegger, this meant that if we are to explore the question, then reason, the, quote, most stiff-necked adversary of thought, unquote, was an obstacle that had to be discarded. Setting aside reason and logic. The question is repugnant to reason, as Heidegger wrote in An Introduction to Metaphysics, because we reach logical absurdity whichever way we go in attempting to answer it. If we say, on the one hand, that there is no answer to the question of why there is being, if being just is for no reason, then that makes being absurd. Something that cannot be explained is an absurdity to reason. But if, on the other hand, we say that being is for a reason, then what could that reason be? We would have to say that that reason, whatever it is outside of being. But outside of being is nothing, which means that we would have to try to explain being from nothingness, which is also absurd. So either way we go in trying to answer the question, we are deeply into absurdity. Logic, at this point, wants to forbid the question. Logic wants to say that the absurdity shows that the question is ill-formed and so should be set aside. Logic wants instead to make the existence of reality its axiom and to proceed from there with discovering the identities of the various existents. On the other hand, switching back to a Heideggerian perspective, The questions spawned by the question strike very deep feelings in Dasein. What about the nothingness that being would have come from? Could being not have been? Could being return once again to the nothing? Such questions are compellingly awesome, and yet at the same time they fill Dasein with a sense of dis-ease and anxiety. So here Dasein has a conflict. Logic and reason say that the question is contradictory and so should be set aside. But Dasein's feelings urge Dasein to explore the question in a nonverbal, emotional way. So which does Dasein choose? Contradiction and feeling, or logic and reason? Fortunately, as we have learned from Hegel, Schopenhauer, Kierkegaard, and Nietzsche, this contradiction and conflict is yet another sign that logic and reason are impotent. As we should all know by now, we should expect to find conflict and contradiction at the heart of things. Contradiction is the sign that we are on to something important. So, mere logic, Heidegger concluded, quote, an invention of school teachers, not of philosophers, unquote, cannot and should not get in the way of probing the ultimate mystery that is being. We must reject entirely the assumption, quote, that in this inquiry, logic is the highest court of appeal, that reason is the means and thinking the way to an original comprehension of nothing and its possible revelation, unquote. Again, quote, if this contradiction breaks the sovereignty of reason in the field of inquiry into nothing and being, then the fate of the rule of logic is also decided. The very idea of logic disintegrates in the vortex of more original questioning. Unquote. And again, in case we have missed the point, quote, authentic speaking about nothing always remains extraordinary. It cannot be vulgarized. It dissolves if it is placed in the cheap acid of merely logical intelligence. Unquote. Deep feeling about nothing trumps logic any day. Emotions as revelatory. Having subjected reason and logic to destruction, and then set them aside as merely one superficial way of thinking, one that the Greeks had established fatefully for all subsequent Western thought, we need another route to being and nothing. We can try to explore language without the presuppositions of reason and logic, but even the elements of language, words, have evolved over time and become so twisted and crusted over with layers of meaning that they almost entirely hide being from us. Their original force and contact with reality has been lost. We can, therefore, try to strip away from our language the encrusted layers to reveal the words that had original and genuine connective force to being, but that will require special efforts. For Heidegger, the special effort that is required is emotional, an exploratory letting oneself go into the revelatory emotions of boredom, fear, guilt, and dread. Boredom is a good mood to start with. When we are bored, really, really, really bored, we are no longer engaged with the ordinary, trivial, day-to-day things that occupy most of our time. When we are bored, quote, drifting hither and thither in the abysses of existence like a mute fog, unquote, all beings become a matter of indifference, undifferentiated from one another. Everything merges or dissolves into an undistinguished unity. Progress has thus been made. Quote, this boredom reveals what is in totality. Unquote. Real boredom takes one away from one's normal focus on particular beings and one's cares for them, and diffuses one's awareness into a sense of being as a whole's being revealed to one. But this revelation also brings with it anxiety and dread, for part of the process of the dissolution of particular beings into a state of undifferentiation is the dissolution of one's own sense of being a unique, individual being. One has the feeling of beings being dissolved into an undifferentiated being. But at the same time, one has the feeling of one's self-identity as also slipping into a state of being nothing in particular, that is, of becoming nothing. This is distressing. Quote, in dread, we are in suspense, wir schweben. Or, to put it more precisely, dread holds us in suspense because it makes what is in totality slip away from us. Hence, we too, as existence in the midst of what is, slip away from ourselves along with it. For this reason, it is not you or I that has the uncanny feeling, but one. Unquote. This sense of dread that comes with the sense of dissolution of all beings along with oneself was for Heidegger a metaphysically potent state, for in effect one gets a foretaste of one's own death, a sense of one's being annihilated, a sense of going into nothingness, and thus a sense of getting to the metaphysical center of being. One must absolutely not, therefore, give into one's overpowering sense of distress and run away from dread and back to the safety of one's petty day-to-day life. One must embrace one's dread and surrender to it, for, quote, the dread felt by the courageous, unquote, is the emotional state that prepares one for the ultimate revelation. That ultimate revelation is of the truth of Judeo-Christian and Hegelian metaphysics. In dread, we come to feel that being and nothing are identical. This is what all philosophy based on the Greek model had missed, and what all philosophies not based on the Greek model had been struggling toward. Quote, nothing, wrote Heidegger, not merely provides the conceptual opposite of what is, but is also an original part of essence, unquote. Heidegger credited Hegel with having reclaimed this lost insight for the Western tradition. Quote, pure being and pure nothing are thus one and the same. This proposition of Hegel's is correct. Unquote. Hegel, of course, got it from trying to resuscitate the Judeo-Christian account of creation, in which God created the world out of nothing. As Heidegger put it in reaffirming that Judeo-Christian claim, quote, every being, insofar as it is a being, is made out of nothing. Unquote. So, after abandoning reasoning and logic, after experiencing real boredom